489134.
Newsreel cameraman Jim Wright, reel 4. Perhaps could you begin by explaining how the distribution of the British Paramount newsreel was organised?
I think the underlying thought behind all news, all editors of newsreels, was to make their newsreels as good as possible, or better than the next person's, with the idea of securing the contract in the cinemas throughout the country. You see, cinemas accept the circuits. There were a number of circuits, like Odeon and people like that, that were controlled. Now, for instance, Odeon was controlled by an offshoot of Gaumont. And they tended to use Gaumont British. Now, this didn't apply to other circuits. All cinemas would naturally want to show the finest films of the day. It didn't matter who produced them, whether it was Paramount or whatever company produced the film, Fox or anybody else. They wanted to show the best cinemas best films in their cinemas in order to get the biggest audience. That's simple business. The newsreels didn't compete that way. We tried to make everybody try to make the best newsreel in the hope that a cinema owner would think our newsreel better than the opposition and would book our newsreel. And therefore, it was strict competition for business at all times. And the company that was able to convince the cinema owner that his reel was better than anybody else's, he got his reel booked. That's how we got our circulation.
Of what form did trying to convince the cinema owner that your newsreel was
quality of take? Quality of presentation. What other way could you do it?
Were they entertained, brought to London to see your film?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Gracious me. And there wasn't all that amount of money floating around. Oh, no. No, they saw the newsreel. They could see the newsreels and in other cinemas, I dare say, I don't know how a cinema owner would decide that one newsreel was better than another unless he went to see it. But we didn't bring them to London or anything like that. I don't think anybody did that. I mean, that would cost far too much money, and the price of newsreels was competitive in those days. And I don't think
anybody. Did they all cost the same?
Approximately. I think so. I have no knowledge of that. I don't know what other companies charge. Some people may have unwittingly undercut, for all I know. I don't think so, though, but they might have done. There's nothing to stop them. There's nothing to stop us or any other company from undercutting its rivals if we wanted to.
But you can't recall your company having done that.
I don't think so. I don't think it was ever in anybody's mind to do that. We knew what it cost to produce the newsreel at an economic price. If you made it too expensive, nobody would book it. Therefore, you made it as attractive as possible, price-wise. And everybody did the same thing. I think most newsreels were approximately the same cost.
Did you believe that audiences would go to one cinema to see a newsreel in preference to another, rather than in order to see the main feature?
Wouldn't know that. I wouldn't know that. I don't think anybody would know that. We never even gave it a thought. I didn't give a damn who went to a cinema to see the newsreel or not. All I was concerned with when I became editor of the newsreel was to make the newsreel as good, if not better, than anybody else's. I tried my hardest to do that. And it was not for me. I wasn't in charge of sales. There's a sales force who does that. It's up to them. I was only the producer. Once I'd produced a newsreel, and once I'd produced a newsreel which I considered to be as good, if not better than anybody else's on the market, then it was somebody else's job to sell it, not mine. None of the newsreel editors had the job, the onus of selling their newsreel. They could only sell it in an abstract way by making it as good as they possibly could with the budget they had to available.
Was there an unofficial competition to see which company made the best newsreel each week?
No. Right. Oh, no.
But you would always watch the other four?
We used to have an arrangement where we screened all the newsreels for all the news editors. There was a weekly meeting or a bi-weekly meeting of the newsreels, because the newsreels were issued twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, or Sundays and Thursdays, if you like. And the newsreels were screened in one of the theatres in London, belonging to one of the companies, taking it in turns, and all the editors used to turn up to look at each other's product, swear at each other or pat each other on the back, as the case may be. If you've got an exclusive, well, of course, people say, well, well done, congratulations, or to hell with you, or whatever. Very friendly it was, I can assure you. There was a different spirit then than there is now. What I think there is now, anyhow. I wouldn't know, I'm not in the business anymore. I'm not in the news business anymore. But judging by what is going on and what I see going on, I imagine it's a miserable existence.
You mentioned how certain of the circuit cinemas, Odeon, for instance, had an arrangement with Goldman. Did your company have an arrangement with anyone?
No.
Nope.
Not that I know of. I don't. I can't answer any questions like that because I was a news editor. I'm not a salesman. You must ask the sales organizations of the companies. They will tell you that. I don't know. I didn't care either. I was my only living. Waking thoughts, or whatever you like to call the thoughts, was to make as good a newsreel as anybody else, or better than anybody else. Mainly better, if I could. We all thought we had the best commentators. We all thought we had the best top cameraman. We all thought we had the best presentation. There was a very strong esprit de corps in all the companies.
Paramount is different from the other newsreels in having anonymous commentators, is that correct?
No, I don't think he was anonymous. I think everybody knew John Stagg. I think he knew the name very well. We didn't publicise him like the other people did because we didn't quite believe in that. We would rather the audience judge the newsreel as a whole, not from the voice of a commentator. Some of the other newsreels, I think, made a mistake in trying to build up their commentators into a sort of a public figure like the present Diana Ford or Angela Rippon type. But I don't agree with that. I think that's all wrong. Commentators are very commentators. They're newsreaders. By all means, have a man who is got a very pleasant voice, by all reason have a man who knows what he's saying and what he's writing, because he usually has to write the script.
Did the Paramount commentator write his own script?
Oh yes, he did all his own script as well as speak it. Now a movie tone, I think Mitchell, who's still alive, Leslie Mitchell, a very dear friend of mine. I think he used to write most of his own stuff as well. Now, I don't know anything at all about the other people. I only know about Movietone because of my association with them, my close association with them, having started off my life, newsreel life with them. Now, I think Leslie Mitchell was a very, very fine commentator in his day, but of course Movietone did build him up. And, quite a personality to build up. We had I suppose you could say John Stagg had a personality, but he was a much more retiring man than Mitchell. I don't think he would have cared to have been forced into the limelight. He knew he was good, and he was good. He was one of the best commentators we've ever had. I think John Stagg... don't confuse the name Stag with Snag. And Stag's a BBC man. But Stag is the man, John Stag, a very good man, dead now. In fact, they're all dead.
Some recent historical articles and indeed a BBC television programme with which you were involved, although you decided not to appear in it, have suggested that the newsreels in the 1930s were very conservative and establishment oriented. What is your reaction to that criticism?
I wouldn't agree that we were establishment oriented. Or is that the word, the correct word, oriented or orientated?
Either.
Right. Well, the the moment you become attached to the government of the day, then you are hamstrung very considerably. It doesn't matter what government it is, what colour of banner you're flying, you become hamstrung. And we didn't agree to that. I don't think you could say any of us favoured one side or the other. In fact, we went out of our way to be completely neutral. At least I did, and I'm certain Cummins did when he was before me, and I'm certain that Gordon Craig and Castleman and Knight and other people, Louis Baer of Gaumont before Castleman and Knight, and the man before Howard Thomas of Pathé. They were people who were quite neutral, I think is the word. I think it's the only safe way to be in a newsreel. I think, have you seen the newsreels lately? The television newsreels lately?
Yes, I have.
Well, aren't you a bit ashamed at the way they're treating this Irish problem? I am.
Well, it's an entirely different approach to news.
It's not it's definitely one-sided. I can't understand the head of the BBC allowing it to go on. I mean, the recent business that has happened only this week. A shocking thing. Not the way to treat news. You can't glorify murderers. You can't glorify terrorism. By all means, show it. By all means, film it as it actually happens. Do you know that if we had a cameraman who had paid somebody to start a riot, like the rent-a-mob jobs, or to some cameraman arrange for that kid that appeared on television news the other night throwing a bottle full of a Molotov cocktail with a man handing it to him behind the wall, that was arranged by some newsreel cameraman. I don't know what nationality, I don't know what country. Somebody must know, but I don't know. But I think it was a disgraceful thing to do. And in our day, if any one of our cameramen had done such a thing, he would have been instantly dismissed. By all means, go out and film things as they happen, but not arrange them. Not like that.
Back to the 1930s. Just one more question. You mentioned that you thought the newsreels then were neutral, but the actual accents of the commentators are all very much middle or upper class accents, I think you will agree.
Well, you're not going to have a commentator. You've got to have. I think everybody tried to get a commentator with a nice, I don't like the word upper class, I would rather say a nice modulated voice.
A very well educated voice.
Well, if you like to put it that way, but I just don't like this business. Well, I know people who speak very, very well indeed who've only had a very poor education. I mean, I can quote you politicians who've never been to a public school, never been to a college, never been to anything else but an ordinary Common or Garden School, you speak extraordinarily well. You speak as you teach yourself to speak. Whether you do it in a university or a college, or whether you do it in the university of life. No, I don't know what the politics were of the commentators. And I know that I had none. I had none when I was an editor, when I was editor, and I don't think anybody else did. I never heard anybody discuss politics. We filmed people like Mosley when he was rampaging around, but we didn't glorify him. We just showed it as news. If he was doing a march, same as you film a march, the Jarrow Walkers. You can't say that because you filmed the Jarrow Walkers, you must be obviously a socialist or a Marxist or something of that description. Or you take a picture of Arthur Scargill spouting his head off. You can't say that because you do that, you're a communist, like he is. No, you can't accuse editors of that. No editor ever allows himself to be drawn into an argument of that description. An editor must be non-partisan. Otherwise, he's no damn good at his job. He can't be. That's where they're making the mistake today, some of them. They're being very partisan. And it's wrong.
Can we now move on to the outbreak of war and the reaction of the newsreel companies to this event?
Yes, I can. Of course, I think most editors or newsreel editors knew that something was cooking from the moment Neville Chamberlain went off to Germany to see Hitler. I mean, it was quite obvious that the march of events that was going on, we'd had pictures from Germany. In fact, one of our German cameramen went on to Hitler's staff during the war. That was the end of him, as far as we were concerned, but he was killed. I think he lost his life in the bunker with Hitler.
Can you recall the actual outbreak of war?
Oh, yes, I can. I remember on the Saturday before Neville Chamberlain spoke to the nation, there was an announcement that he would be speaking to the nation on the Sunday morning. And of course, the moment he declared that we were at war with Germany, I phoned the editor, Mr. Cummins, and said, "Well, what should we do? What's the best thing to do?" So he said, "Well, I think you better get down to the office right away. I'll meet you there. And we'll take it from there on." And in going to the office, I was rather amazed at the vast amount of traffic and cars that were leaving London early Sunday morning, travelling westward. Is this true? I noticed it. I noticed a vast number of cars hurrying along the Western Avenue, which I had to travel east. They were travelling west. They were, because everybody thought that as soon as the war was declared, we were going to be bombed. So naturally, if we were going to be bombed, we've got to get cameramen alerted, and we're going to have pictures of it, because that's news. There was no other news to film. We certainly weren't going to film the people scuttling out of London because they thought they were going to be bombed. And of course, as you know, the air raids...
You decided not to film that.
No, we didn't film that at all. I hadn't got a cameraman available. They were all at home. I hadn't called them in then by this time.
But if you had had cameramen available, would you have thought of that?
No, I didn't. Well, I wouldn't have thought about it. I just looked at it and it went through my mind. Saw the lemons rushing to the Norwegian coast to drown themselves in the Atlantic. But I think that was a thought that went through my mind at the time. It's a natural, self-preservation is the first law of nature anyhow. I mean, you don't stand still and wait for somebody to shoot at you or explode something at your feet, you get away. That's why I'm alive today.
But if you had shown this in the newsreels, it would have had a demoralizing effect, so would you therefore not have included it?
It never occurred to me. I agree with you, it would have had a demoralizing, but it never occurred to me to film it. And I don't think it occurred to anybody else to film it. And, of course, the air raid siren went, as you know, shortly after, and I don't know why that was, what happened there. Somebody must have pressed the panic button. But I know I phoned the cameraman, I don't know which one now, and said, well, you heard the news, yes. I said, well, be prepared to, you know, do something quickly when we know something's happening. There's nothing happening at the moment, but you're on call. So that was it. But we didn't call anybody out that day. But, of course, when we were at war, there was a great deal of activity and lots of things to be filmed. For instance, the different plans the government had were put very quickly into operation. There was the sandbagging of government offices. There was all sorts of things like that going on. Then, of course, there was the movement of troops. I don't recall much about that. I don't know what we did there.
As I understand, the newsreels were not allowed to film by the army the embarkation of the BEF. And the newsreels objected.
May well be. I don't know. I don't remember. I don't remember that. I really don't. I know we filmed the evacuation of the children, which is a very harrowing business. I thought it was one of the most terrible parts of the war, getting the kids out of the towns into the country and to safety, or what was considered to be safe. That's a debatable point. When they, after the Germans bombed Exeter and places in the far west, we thought we were sending kids to safety. They might have been sending them to more dangerous places. Well, London was bad enough, anyhow. But of course, as soon as the air raid started, we had plenty to do.
Before quite the air raid, so had the newsreels, either individually or through their association, before the war, when war seemed almost inevitable, attempted to develop closer contacts with the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy?
Didn't need to. We had very close contacts with the Army, Navy, and Air Force. Every newsreel had very, very good contacts with the armed services.
Also the Army's decision to deny.
And don't forget, we had been making pictures long before the war of different developments that were going on. As I told you previously, we'd filmed the Navy. The Navy were very helpful. They never refused us pictures of different naval activities. We had Army events, and Salisbury Plain, manoeuvres, and large parades of tanks, and so on and so forth. They never stopped any of that. I can't recall much about the Air Force, although we had plenty of facilities from the RAF, training of Royal Air Force and things like that. But there wasn't an awful lot to film in that direction. But if we had there been, I'm certain the authorities would have given us permission to do it. It was as much to their advantage to have as much propaganda as possible as it was to us to get as much news as possible.
One would have thought so, also for the first few months.
There's always some busybody at what I call a chairborne warrior somewhere who feels he's very, very important, has got to say no to something or other, justify his existence. We found a lot of that various times. I did it all my life.
How many staff were there at Paramount on the outbreak of war?
About 200 altogether.
And cameramen?
About six. Nobody had any more than that, six or seven. All the newsreels had roughly about the same number of men. It didn't need any more.
Did you think of increasing the number when war broke out?
It isn't something that you can go overnight to the a supermarket and get. Cameramen takes a long time to train. Took me a long time to become even a war correspondent cameraman, which is not an expert cameraman, but just somebody who takes a camera to war, that's all. But I'd learnt the camera business by association with cameramen, by watching cameramen work, by taking an odd picture now and again, once or twice, at various times, helping out. whenever an odd camera position was needed on a big news event. But I knew naturally about making pictures, and that it's not a very difficult subject, take pictures of a kind. What else I can say on that particular subject?
So it would be pointless to ask you how cameramen were selected if you had a more or less static complement.
Well, it would be pointless because a cameraman had to... He didn't come to us to be trained. We did actually train people. We had... we took on two or three people later on, young people. And they were trained by us. And I think other newsreels did the same thing. We realized that we had to train people. But you see, until the war started, until our resources were stretched to the limit, it wasn't necessary. We were able to use our men in a sensible way. We had an exchange arrangement with other newsreels abroad. We had amicable arrangements with other newsreels in this country. We were quite friendly in many respects. So I suppose when it came to big events where you had to have a lot of cameramen, like a royal funeral or a royal wedding or a coronation, well, the newsreels pooled their resources. Well, then you've seen the photograph of the combined newsreels. Must have seen it somewhere. It's a very large number of cameras, a very large number of cameramen there. And don't forget, in addition to all these people, there were a very large number of what is loosely called freelance cameramen. They are people who had invested in a camera, probably started off in a 60mm and then bought themselves a 35mm. And were taking pictures in different parts of the country. And all these freelance cameramen were available, were known to the newsreel industry, and were available for use if necessary. In fact, on one occasion, our staff of six cameramen was increased to a staff of 30 in order to cover a large event you were covering. The same occurred in anything, any event like that. We always are able to draw on freelance cameramen. And a word you used, stringers. We don't like the word stringer. We used to use freelance cameramen. And same as world coverage, very often covered with freelance cameramen or cameramen doing the same thing in all the different countries of their birth. Apart from our arrangements with, established newsreels, like Nodo in Madrid, and forgotten the Japanese name, I could never pronounce it anyhow. There was a newsreel company in Japan, very, very helpful people.
As the news editor, did you have any responsibility for the allocation of staff to the different war zones? Or was this Tommy Cummins' task?
Well, that would be a combined job between the two of us. He's the editor, he makes the final decision. The thing would come in, they want a cameraman, for argument's sake, to Jimmy Gemmell was the man who sat on the cliff tops of Dover in the early days of the war, in a special arrangement they fitted up there on the top for him, sandbagged and whatnot. And he was given permission to sit there like a sore thumb on the top of the cliffs to film the raids over the channel. He got quite a lot of material, excellent material, of ships being bombed and airplanes coming down in the water. A lot was filmed by Gemmell. Can't think of any other for a moment. There were a number of places.
Morris Ford, for instance, covered the evacuation of Burma.
Oh, yes, he was sent out. He was, there was Morris Ford, and the man you mentioned who went out there. And there was Ted Jenock, who went out to the Middle East. He also went down and filmed the raid on Massawa. He went on to Singapore and was the last man out, one of the last men out of Singapore, went on to and got transportation to Mesopotamia, to Australia, and then from Australia on to America, where he stayed. He never came back to England.